Subcommittee will come to order. The first bill in our work session is 2492.
Mr. Chief, committee members, this is a bill that was requested by Dr. Alexander and established a procedure for the matching of missing persons to unidentified human remains. This morning I was contacted by Shirley Davidson from one of those, I forget, it's like LEDS, it's what's the name of that? Is it LEDS? Okay.
Is he here now?
Yeah, they have rewritten the basic proposal in the bill, as I understand it, and I have these materials to pass out to you, but I have not previously seen them. And I guess I should just leave it to him to explain, but it's all connected with an FBI identification system that's being established. We also have a letter from Scott Gallant of the Oregon Medical Association, and that was in reference to the referral in the bill to on page 2, line 7, that had to do with an inclusion in the agency report of copies of any medical records. And he reflects that he had a conversation with Dr. Brady, the state medical examiner, and Dr. Brady made the following points: that his office may ask for hospital records, the front sheet, in 1% or less of these cases, and in rare instances requests, in fact once in 5 years, information from the local physician. And he stated that he and his staff would not ask for anything involving a personal record, but might ask for some fundamental medical history or serious medication being taken by a missing person, or information about a serious disease. He said also that it was very rare that a physician's records would clinch an identification, and he hadn't had any notable difficulty when necessary in obtaining information from a physician. He states in the final analysis, Dr. Brady stated the language on page 2, line 7 of House Bill 2492, the words medical or was not really necessary, and OMA requests that that language be deleted from the bill. I think that the issue about medical records is also in the proposal that is before you now.
Okay. Questions before we take the explanation of the amendments? Yeah, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Shirley Davidson, and I am an employee of the State of Oregon, Assistant Manager of the Law Enforcement Data System, otherwise known as LEDS. And with me are Dr. Alexandra, whose request this bill was introduced originally, and Lieutenant Forney from State Police, who would be the operating agency of the bill. House Bill 2492 does address an issue of national concern as well as state concern. That was evidenced by the recent passage last fall of what is known as the Missing Children's Act, which was House Resolution 6976. This act authorizes the FBI to establish a file for the purposes of aiding identification of unidentified human remains, the same objectives as sought in 2492. My purpose in being here today is to call to your attention that they are proceeding with development of that system, which will become operational in June of 1983. The FBI NCIC is also expanding the capabilities of the existing missing persons files, so that there will be cross-matching of unidentified dead records and missing persons records. We are proposing changes to House Bill 2492 that would require participation by Oregon and the National Unidentified Dead and Missing Persons Program. And we have drafted some suggested language, procedural type language, we think a bill could follow and meet the objectives that were set out in the original bill, plus have Oregon as a participant in that system. The, in summing up the changes that are in the proposed new language, we would retain the requirement of the original language in 2492, making the State Police Department, State Police, the central record keeper for the unidentified dead records. A very small number of these annually, and probably should be in a simple spot. We would add the requirement the Department of State Police enter these records into the NCIC system, into the NCIC computer system. We would also delete the requirement in the original bill that the Department of State Police establish a missing persons file and against which they would search unidentified dead records. This would have a terrific impact, I believe, on the Department of State Police. And the other reason for it is our existing already a national missing persons file and a state missing persons file from the lead system. All police departments in the state have currently have access to those systems. It would add a requirement that any police agency taking a missing persons report enter a record into the existing Oregon National Missing Persons files. This is almost done routinely now, but there is no legal requirement, and nowhere in law is a police department required to enter such a record. We feel the proposed changes would greatly increase the probability for identification of human remains, lessen the impact on state police, and would have little impact on local police agencies. The national system changes will have some fiscal impact on us as an operating agency, but that fiscal impact is going to occur whether there's a bill passed or not, because when NCIC changes their formats, expands their missing person file records, we will have to match those changes. So we're going to have to do that anyway, and we anticipate that we'll be able to do it without asking for additional resources. Right now, we have not received the final notification. I couldn't give an estimate. It's going to be 1 or 2 man months or what the cost might be. We're just in a position where we have to do it. So that's going to happen regardless of what happens to 2492. I have in the material furnished on page 2 the amendment that came out of Congress authorizing the FBI to do this. I must say that I was, myself, 2492, I called FBI and CIC to see what the status of it was, because the last discussions I had with them on the bill were quite some time back. In fact, the bill had not passed out of Congress at that point. And I was quite impressed to find out that they're going to be operating in June. And that tells me that there must be some pressure brought to bear, because normally any change there comes 4 or 5 years down the line. So I was both happy and surprised to find out they are moving so fast. I have talked, provided a copy of this bill to Sheriff Kenneth Gowen, who is the representative of the Sheriff's Association on our advisory committee, and the Chief of Police, Lyle Henderson, who is the Chief of Police representative on our advisory committee. And the feedback I've got from both of them is that they like the concept and the rewritten bill much better than the original 2492. I believe it was some double work. But also, I think, improve greatly the chance of identification, because we won't be restricting ourselves just to those people who are found in Oregon or who are missing from Oregon, because it would be part of a national pool of information. Dr. Alexander has, I think, some information relating to systems in other states who will be participating in the national system. And we've also conferred with state police on the bill, and they support the changes at this point. I talked with Dr. Brady this morning. It was the first time he had a chance to look at the material. I said it was Friday, but he had been in his office. He had no problem with it. He did raise the question that shows up on page 3 of the proposed redraft of the bill in section 6 about the requirement for people furnishing information upon request from medical records. The reason that was included for your information is that the NCIC file design is going to accommodate additional medical information such as eyeglass prescriptions, fractures, surgical scars, the type of information that might be of some value identification. So that was included. Because the more information that's in this type of record, the better possibility of possible match. Briefly, how the system would work. If a missing person is entered to the Salem Police Department today, along with identifying characteristics, and 6 months from now, the state of Colorado had an unidentified dead and entered a record, if there were enough similar characteristics, the records would hit. And Salem would be alerted, Colorado had a possibility. Colorado would be alerted, Salem had a missing person with similar characteristics. And from there on, it's up to people to pursue the investigation, qualified people determine if it is or is not the person. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Lieutenant Fortney, as I understand, I want to put aside for just a moment the issue of the medical or professional records. As I understand, the department believes the redraft is a, that you have no objection to the redraft.
No, sir.
Doctor, do you have any further comments that you'd like to share? I take it you reviewed these amendments.
Pardon?
You've reviewed the amendments?
I still
have. You have reviewed these amendments?
Yes, I have. I approve wholeheartedly.
Do you, as a professional, have any comment on this issue that has been raised by the OMA?
Is that on confidentiality, ma'am?
Yes, I guess, Mr. Chair. The issue of doctors being required to provide medical record information on the patients.
In over 30 years of identifying people, it has never come up. Four other states now have similar laws, and I'm in communication with them all the time, and I've never had any occasion to hear that this has arisen at all.
When you say it hasn't come up, have you been involved ever in requesting the information? It's never come up that you've had to request information from a doctor, or the doctor's never objected to providing it?
I'm requesting the information all the time. And
from doctors?
Yes. And all sources. And I can't think of any occasion that I didn't have their cooperation.
May I? Mm-hmm. On missing people or dead people? I mean, is it?
Both.
Okay.
Representative Springer, can I see the letter from the lobbyist for the OMA?
I think, Mr. Chair,
Representative Springer,
when there was the first hearing, my question was, I think, to the sponsor, was just to clarify in the original bill that I thought it appropriate to include medical records as well as dental records. It seemed to make consistent. It seemed to be consistent to me, and I guess I don't understand exactly why the OMA is taking its position. Do they feel it's going to be a burden upon physicians to have to comply with this request? I think that the doctor's testimony indicates that he's never had any problem. I don't know if it's a confidentiality problem or.
Scott here?
Mr. Chair. He's on his way down from Portland and will probably be here before our meeting's over, but
Mr. Chairman,
yes,
perhaps my wife is right. I don't hear as well as I used to, and I may have caused a little problem not understanding the first question. I do now, and I hope everybody else does.
As I understand it, the basis of the concern is that the mandate to comply with the request may involve information that is covered by the doctor-patient privilege? Is that your understanding, Linda?
Mr. Chair,
or is it a different concern?
I don't think the specific concerns expressed in the letter. I think what occurred to me was not so much the cost aspect, although I don't really know what implications there might be for a doctor to provide information for medical records, but I guess I just don't know that much about. I mean, I just sort of hear that there's doctor-patient confidentiality matters, and I don't know at what point doctors ethically or by whatever standards they operate under consent to give out medical information on one of their patients. Well, it's always a hassle on Dr. Quincy. That's what brought it up. So if that's really what brought it to my mind, I don't know.
Well, Mr. Chair, I think
this is fair.
Both the original bill and the newly written bill in Section 4 provide that the agency, if they elect to obtain, pursue this, I guess what we're, there's a system whereby they request the permission or consent of either the reporting person or some, presumably, who may be a family member who's in a position to give, consent. I guess it's difficult for me to, try to guess if confidentiality is a real problem. I just don't see why it would be. Obviously, the concern would seem to me to be pretty overriding in terms of public policy if we're trying to identify some person that's missing, particularly if there is some process for consent or permission to be obtained from the reporting individual, presumably a member of the family or someone with some intimate concern.
What kind of information would a doctor typically provide that would be of assistance here?
Possibly Dr. Alexander could respond to that better than I, but in my discussion with the agent in charge of the FBI, they felt that fractures, for example, in a moment of stupidity, broke an ankle 3 or 4 years ago, that'd be surgically repaired. That would be if my remains were found, that would be a very good means to match those remains with a medical record. Surgical scars, and I was a little surprised to find that they were even going to include eyeglass prescriptions and contact lens prescriptions and stuff, but these criteria for the file are being developed, I'm sure, with a lot of advice from people involved in the business of identifying bodies, such as Dr. Alexander, and he could probably respond better than I could to that question.
Mr. Chairman, just x-rays, whether there's no pathology or not, are very valuable. And dental records are extremely valuable. Contact lenses, prostheses, bones that have been reduced with metal fixation.
Are there further questions of our witnesses? Okay, thank you. Do you have any idea what time Mr. Gallant's going to be here?
I would expect it would be within the hour.
I dislike imposing on all three of you to wait. I wonder if one of you possibly could remain for a bit longer to see if he arrives, and we might get into a brief discussion with him. I'm otherwise inclined to see if we can report the bill with the amendments, but I suppose since he's coming to testify, we better wait.
I believe so.
Yeah. I think it would be a bit unseemly to have the bill gone by the time he gets here. We've heard what the specifics of the concern are. So we'll wait for action on the amendments until we've had a chance to hear from him. Let me make sure. Are there any other questions of our witnesses before we conclude? Okay. The chair would move that, subject to
form and style review by legislative council and their preparation, further preparation in proper form as amendments if any other changes are made, that we adopt the amendments submitted by Mr. Davidson on behalf of Reds, of the executive department.
That motion is also made with the understanding that we'll be holding the amended bill until Mr. Gallant has arrived to deal with the records question. Is there any objection to the amendments? Okay, they're adopted. All right, we'll turn now to 2371.
Mr. Chairman,
Linda,
committee members, House Bill 2371 is the bill that came in at the request of the Commission on the Judicial Branch. At our last hearing of the committee on the bill, committee adopted amendments that had been submitted by Judge Snopper. The basic effect of this bill is, without going into detail of the amendments at this point, is to allow for the reduction of misdemeanors to violations, and as part of that, then not the meaning behind that would be that incarceration is not going to be sought on the offense, and defense counsel would not, as an effect of that, need to be appointed for indigent defendants. Since that meeting, there has been quite a bit of correspondence going back and forth on this bill. Also at the last meeting, the committee agreed that we would have a work session focusing on the focusing on the Brown decision, and also I contacted people who had been involved in the correspondence, had been going back and forth, and who had been involved in testimony on this at previous meetings at the direction of the chair, and invited them to be here to dialogue with the committee about the matters that have been discussed in the correspondence. And I know we have with us today Judge Stauffer, Judge Hargraves, Bob Larson from Lake County Public Defender's Office, Jerry Cooper, and also, is there anybody else besides the Department of Justice? Okay, besides the Department of Justice. Also, we'd ask the Department of Justice to look this bill over and to be prepared also to give us their views on the bill. And Bill Gary and Jim Mountain are here from the Department of Justice.
Well, we might as well ask all of you to come up and see if we can squeeze around the table, and we have your briefs filed. We might as well get the oral argument now.
Can we make our decision in chambers?
Yeah, we're going to issue a per curiam opinion, no names of
I'm distributing copies of, I think you received a lot of the copies of the correspondence been going on. Today I received a letter from the Department of Justice dated March 30th, 1983, that I'm distributing.
I have more letters than the 16th of March.
Has this one been sanitized?
Oh, yes, I think so. March 23rd letter?
I got a March 16th letter. What am I missing?
We should have this one. That was
what are you writing here?
Well, maybe my staff hasn't caught up. Well, if it's sent out, we probably got it.
Gentlemen, if it's any comfort, the legislature will be adjourning in another 2 or 3 months, and you can all get back to doing what it is you normally do as human beings.
I think that's a closing comment rather than an offer.
We concluded our last work session on the issue of the implications of the Brown decision for the direction being taken by the bill. That has been the focus of most of the dialogue that's going on. And what I'd like to do is to see if I can ask, we have circulated that correspondence to the members on a current basis, and what I'd like to do is see if I could ask each of you to try to summarize your views with respect to that question. If there are other matters relating to the bill that you would like to address, I'd like to ask you to hold those for a moment. I'd like to just concentrate on the Brown question initially. Then we'll come back to the merits of the bill apart from that. And I suppose Judge Snopper, since you are one of the proponents, perhaps it'd be appropriate to begin with you, and we'll go from there.
I think what we're all doing is really trying to make a prediction as to what the Oregon Supreme Court might think of this bill in light of Brown versus Multnomah County, Stevenson versus Holston. I think we're all making predictions based upon our best reading of those cases, which are not easy cases to decipher, and we come to somewhat different conclusions. But I don't know that anybody can really make an accurate prediction of what the court might do. I stated as succinctly as I can possibly state it in my first letter why I felt that if the question was presented to the higher court, Stevenson versus Brown versus Multnomah County, would not invalidate this legislation. We're talking about violations, non-criminal convictions, which maximum possible fine that would be a $250 fine for behavior that violates the statutes. I might say that as demonstrated in the recent opinion from the Court of Appeals, City of Portland versus Tuttle, there's a very good example of what's occurring on a daily basis, at least in Multnomah County. Since that, what would otherwise appear to be a violation of criminal statute is treated as a violation by deleting an element. That results in a non-jury trial, non-criminal conviction. And the court, at least with regard to the question on the right to a jury trial, indicated in Tuttle that Brown versus Obama County does not require a jury trial in the violation of prosecution context. So I see that as some indication that in my conclusion that this legislation is not invalid is an accurate prediction. We simply have a very minor penalty. The type of nature of the offenses that Brown versus Multnomah County says that you have to look at is not very helpful, as Justice Lindy says in his opinion, in terms of trying to decipher whether or not you still have essentially a criminal conviction or not. Collateral consequences, such as what was discussed in that case, suspension of the driver's licenses, that's dealt with specifically, I think, in the statute, at least in the context of traffic offenses. And in most criminal cases, of course, you're not going to have any license suspension collateral consequences. Probably the most significant aspect or criterion in Brown versus Multnomah County is the punitive significance. And my comment in my letter about public opinion polls is, perhaps I should elaborate on that. I think it is highly presumptuous of the judge, trial judge or appellate judge, to sit on his bench and say what public opinion is. My reference to public opinion polls was that only way you can truly determine what the public thinks is a good quality, scientifically structured public opinion poll is to public attitude on that. That's what Justice Lindy is indicating as the key significance here. I submit that sitting in Florida making that kind of an estimate is simply not adequate. The fifth criteria, as I think we discussed previously, when the cases start out as a criminal prosecution, the arrest and detention and pretrial screening and so forth is inevitable, and I don't think that's invalidated by a subsequent reduction of the offense to a violation, because that happens very frequently. I don't think anybody here is taking the position that somehow it's unconstitutional to take a case that starts as a misdemeanor and sometime later in the process reduce it to a violation. All this bill tries to do is say, let's make this decision early in the process. That's all we're here. And my best guess, and that's all I think anybody can do, my best guess is that this bill will survive the challenge under Brown and Stevenson versus Olson. Because clearly we're not talking about any incarceration whatsoever.
Question from Jim Springer.
Just now for can you advise us to what I think you made reference earlier that in Multnomah County apparently